All right. God, thank you for the opportunity to gather. Thank you for bringing Zach here safely. And we surrender this time to care and control, and we trust that it'll find who it needs to find. Amen.
Amen.
All right.
All right. Ooh, the new intro. Welcome to The Most High Show, made by and for people in recovery, a show about recovery, spirituality, and being human. Our mission is to provide impactful, community-driven media that informs, empowers, and inspires positive change. Real people, real stories, real life. This is The Most High Show.
Hey! What an intro.
Tell you what.
Yeah, who wrote that?
That was off the cuff, I feel like, right?
Yeah, for sure. Join us for a game-changing session with Dr. Zach, neuropsychologist, former NCAA Division I athlete, and founder of Neurosports Performance and Team Audacity. They go beyond the usual strength plans, mental skills work, and recovery protocols by focusing on what drives all of it, the brain. Using principles like neuroplasticity, mirror neurons, and brain governor override, they rewire the brain to elevate physical performance for athletes, coaches, teams, and entire organizations. If you're ready to think beyond traditional sports performance, this is the session you don't want to miss.
Ooh, that was pretentiously worded, wasn't it?
You know what?
Take it up
with Mr. Pretentious over here. Mm. Co-host Pretentious.
No, actually, Dr. Zach sent me that. So.
Oh, come on, man.
The truth comes out.
Make sure you talk onto the microphone. Yeah. You want it like an ice cream cone, but don't lick it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, talk to the talk box.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show. All
right. Well, thank you for joining us tonight.
Absolutely.
Why don't you, for our new listeners, I know it's been a while since you've been on the show last, like reintroduce, who are you? What is neuropsychologist? What does that mean?
Yeah. Man, nobody knows, you know? No, my name's Zach Giannis. Last name is weird, so people just call me Dr. Zach or Dr. Z usually. But, so I'm a neuropsychologist by trade, which is a fancy way of saying that my job is to understand how the brain works. Different parts of it, how it works together. That way, when something is off with it, I understand and can help people understand why it's not working correctly. Whether it's because it's something they're born with, something they've acquired, maybe they're in a car accident, hit their head really hard, or had a stroke, or assault, or any different way you can think of that, you know, you hit your head or have an injury. Or if it's something you get as you get older, you know, little old ladies and gentlemen who are afraid they might have dementia. So my job was just to run them through some things and see how their brain was functioning, come up with a diagnosis and treatment recommendations and make life a little easier for them. Through that process, you know, I worked at a lot of really great hospitals. Worked at one here in town. It specializes in brain and spinal cord injury. And I found that I loved what I did, but for some reason I was still waking up in the morning and feeling really anxious and stressed and having trouble getting in. Losing weight and everything else. And what I realized is I love what I did, but I wasn't doing it in the right environment. Mm-hmm. Right. And that doesn't take anything away from my patients that I worked with, and I loved them all and the people that I worked with, but the setting. Mm-hmm. So a little bit about me, my past. I come from a place in a family where, you know, graduating high school is a big deal for most people, more or less going to college. So I was a first-generation college student, and from there I met my wife, who we were talking about earlier, that chick, Christy. And,
chick and is a term of endearment.
Term of endearment.
Let's be clear.
Right. But, it, you know, going to college and becoming a doctor and having the life I have, man, and it comes back to sports. Mm. All right. So I was what you call, like a lot of people probably hear and listen, an at-risk youth, so to speak, you know. Didn't know what college was, but I could run. And I found out you could run in college. I didn't know that was a thing. And I knew I needed to get away. So running took me away. And if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't have my career. I wouldn't have my family. I wouldn't have my children. I wouldn't have the life that I have now. I don't know that I'd be alive. And so I realized that's where I need to be. Hmm. Right? Like God gave me that gift. You know, it took me a while to listen to him. And the only way I could think of giving back was taking what I learned and knowledge I gained about the brain and applying it to help people realize opportunities and excel in sports performance and hopefully have a life that they otherwise thought they couldn't.
So you've, like, merged two passions into one is what I'm hearing.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
And you literally ran away from your problems.
I did.
But in a good way.
Yeah, in a good way.
Yeah, that's what I'm glad you said that because that's all I could think of is like, no, but literally.
No,
yeah.
But literally.
How hard was it for you to hold that back, you know?
Like, really hard.
Yeah. Good job.
Did you have a scholarship?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I had an athletic scholarship, and your boy was wicked smart, so... You know, even though I didn't go to school, I almost didn't graduate high school just because I never showed up. But I had an academic scholarship because my grades were good. And, you know, minority scholarship because, you know.
Because why not?
Why not? So, you know, it worked out. There's no way I was going to afford something like that. It was a private school, you know. Funny fact, it's a Christian-affiliated school. I wasn't aware of that when I attended. I just knew it was far away from home.
Uh-huh.
And they're giving me money. So it's a bit of a culture shock.
Oh yeah,
initially,
and then you probably had to sign like some sort of behavioral covenant.
God,
and...
which I immediately broke.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
like a good troubled youth.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we had a role play. You know, couldn't let my peeps down. But yeah.
Well, what can we learn from athletic performance psychology in our own recovery and personal growth? Oh,
man, so this is huge. So. One of the things I think I've realized as I've gotten older, and I think we all tend to do as we see more of the world and gain more experience, is that everything's connected, right? If you ask me, the true measure of intelligence isn't how well you do on tests or anything else. It's can you draw connections between things that seem unrelated and find a way to connect them to make them better or make it easier or to help others?
See, when I connect things that are seemingly unrelated, everyone tells me I'm paranoid and I need to go take a nap.
Fantastic. That was great.
It depends on what we're connecting.
Yes, right.
You know?
Right.
You know.
What are you connecting that's not paranoia?
You know, we could talk later.
Okay.
You know, if I need to. So some of the things I thought we would talk about tonight is what separates us as a company, what we do with people from other sports performance organizations or coaches or trainers. And it's that we take a neuroscience approach, all the things I learned to help patients recover after a brain injury, to regain movement, to regain functions, to regain their memory, and apply it to people, to athletes, in a way that's digestible and unique, so that they realize, hey, it's not my body that hits my physical limits, it's the thing that drives it, which is your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so many people don't realize that. It's that the limits you think you have, I've heard athletes say over and over again, and this has also got it to me, because just, man, it legit hurt my heart when I'd see these athletes start to give up on their dreams because they thought they reached their physical peak.
Mm.
And, you know, a lot goes into that. You know, I talk a lot about just the culture of sports, and we see this in the recovery community too. I call it a soft cap culture, or kind of this like bubble wrap culture, where it's well-intentioned, where we want to care for these people and these athletes and our loved ones by doing things like, well, let's not get our hopes up too high, right? Or let's just scale back and start here instead.
Yeah, like don't shoot for the moon, because if you miss, that fall's going to hurt.
Yeah, right? And every time when I hear coaches say stuff like that, or sometimes they don't even say anything, but the vibe comes through and it is heard. Right, it's like an athlete might say, oh, I have a really good goal. Like a male athlete might say, hey, you know what? I want to run a 4:15 mile this year, which is fast for a high schooler. And the coach or the parents might just not say anything. It's like, oh, okay. Right. Well, what they're hearing is, well, that's ridiculous.
Mm.
Right. And so there's a parallel there. I think we see with even the recovery community. Right. So for those of us who've recovered and we're coming out, and we might say something like, I want to start my own business. And the well-intentioned response may be, well, why don't we just start with getting a job first, right?
Mm.
Well, sure, but what are we hearing there, right?
Now I'm feeling really bad for what I said last week with Kirk.
That's where I went to.
Yeah, yeah. So
well,
keep going.
I brought it up, so tell me more.
Yeah. Well, no, because that is like, that's a lot of, there's like a lot of lofty goals and kind of an idealistic level of thinking, you know, especially in early recovery or in the beginning of any kind of journey.
Yeah.
And so sometimes having such a big goal that's so kind of out there, and not knowing to break that goal up into digestible, bite-sizable bits, when someone doesn't immediately gain massive amounts of progress towards that goal, they become discouraged and can revert to old behaviors.
And that's also knowing too, like coupled with the discouragement is like the chances of them failing is so high. And so it's like seeing people make, you know, like the old behaviors going back out based off of this failure, based off of this discouragement. So it's like, yes, it's great. You want to start a business, or it's great that this is the goal. And it's like, but what we have seen so many times is that goal might be setting you up for failure in a catastrophic way.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, how do you like dance on the line of encouraging towards an incredible but lofty goal while also keeping things rooted in reality and what's more realistic?
Yeah. So it sounds like, how do we hold up both?
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's what we're missing, right? As coach, we go either or. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. And we have this as a just as a culture in general, we are a very risk averse culture, right? As humans, right? Which means our biggest fear is what we might lose, not what we might gain. Right. The kids young, I don't know if they still do or not. I'm old, but like FOMO, fear of missing out.
Yeah.
Right. That's why it drives so much people to do things. So it's being able to hold that. So I think it's different between saying, well, I don't think you're going to be able to do that. Why don't you just get a job first, right? Versus saying, man, that is a great goal. Like, I don't see why you can't do that. Hey, what do you think would be the kind of the first steps of getting there?
Yeah.
Right? What do you think we might need to do first, man? We want to get you along there, right? And then that opens up the conversation saying, instead of hearing, like, I don't think you can, you're not capable, those hidden messages, like, yeah, I believe in you, right? But let's be realistic and say, hey, where do we need to start?
Yeah.
Right. That first step. And let's celebrate all those small achievements and then be able to pepper in like, hey, you know what? What you're talking about is admirable. Hey, man, I can't wait to see you shoot for that, because oftentimes it's not the goal, it's the journey. Right.
I think Miley Cyrus has a song about
she
that.
Does. I stole it.
You're like, I'm going to replace the word. No one will know.
No one knows. It's not covered. But it's but you do that. But then along the way, you also say, hey, what do you think is going to be challenging about that? Right. What do you foresee could be some hardships along the way with that?
So go ahead and get them thinking about the potential of the difficulty instead of meeting them with the difficulty.
Yeah. Right. Well, is that life that's taught you that, or is it neuroscience that taught you that?
So for me, it was neuroscience, because I always said I make the best decisions in life coming up. Right. But you talk to people, and it's like almost intuitive for some.
Okay.
Right. But what we know of neuroscience is, even with addiction, you know, people talk about these mental blocks, these relapses, and, you know, I've kind of been pushing about, well, if you just look at it as like a faulty circuit, right? And so even with addiction, we have, it's these faulty circuits that run over and over in our brain, right? Because everything that we do, our brain has a program for. So the first time we take a hit, the first time we take a drink, the first time we do whatever, right? We feel that in our neurons, which is just a fancy way of saying our brain cells. Right, they say, huh, that was interesting. Right, I wonder if we're gonna do that again. Let's actually reach out to some of our buddies in case we do, so we have a more coordinated effort next time.
Okay.
Right. Now our brain is lazy. It says, I want to create any new programs, forming new connections, unless it has to. So it says, but let's just do a few. Then you do it again, and then your neurons are like, all right, I guess we might do this again. Let's just go ahead and form a few more connections, make it even easier next time. And then you do it again. All right, I guess we're doing this. Let's form some more connections. And influence these connections, and every time we do it, good habit or bad habit, those connections get stronger until now we're doing it without even thinking, and now it's a habit. Right? And so what we're doing here when we're doing
that, and that's kind of the that's the way the brain is, like, I would say, meant to function, or I'd say designed, but like that is optimal brain functioning, right?
Absolutely.
Is quickest route to desired outcome or whatever. Yep. Right?
And it's efficient. Right? It doesn't want to reinvent the wheel every time.
Yeah.
Right? Now, when that happens, that's happening whether every time we learn something new, right? When you're in school and you're studying and learn something new, you learn somebody's name, you memorize a verse or a passage, you remember a new route to a restaurant. Those neurons have to connect, form new connections, and now that's a new pattern. Right? So those can be good patterns and bad patterns are always happening. So what we do is, and we can do some recovery as well, is, hey, let's take advantage of that. is identify those, that faulty circuit that's been firing, right? Because you're not broken, right? It's just a faulty circuit, and we can rewire it. Now, it takes time because our brain is stubborn, doesn't like change. We don't like change. Whenever you have to change something, what's the first, like, if you had to change some routine or something, like, how would you feel? Like, what comes up for you?
I'm literally going through that right now.
Yeah.
I fantasize about running away constantly.
Yeah, right? It sends you into almost panic mode. We all, like, our fight or flight kind of kicks in. Mm-hmm. We're going to avoid. We're going to fight against it. Right? We're going to freeze up and do nothing. Mm. Right? Reason why is because our brain's like, no. We work hard to get this program in place. It runs fine. Don't make us fix it or replace it. Mm. And that's what we're trying to do is we're putting these new circuits down. Right? And that's where we affect change. Now, I'll be honest, like, how do we get here? What was the question I was answering, Christian?
Right. Well, the question was, what can we learn from athletic performance psychology in our own recovery and personal growth?
And we're talking about people who have these lofty goals. And,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And athletes who, whether they're in a culture of that's kind of either silence of... complicit to that's too great of a goal, mm-hmm. or outright someone saying, nah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And it sounds like what you're describing is taking the goal seriously, mm-hmm. and then asking, and you said this about confronting it head on, like what are going to be the challenges?
Yeah.
What is the path to get to where you want? Right. Mm-hmm. And I know, like, if I have a coaching client, that's what a lot of that work is. It's early, it's like we're trying to identify, what do you want? Mm-hmm. Okay, you want to whatever. Is it stop drinking, or you want to, you know, build your business? And so every time we meet challenges or frustrations or setbacks, it's like, okay, well, you said you really wanted this. Mm-hmm. Is that still what you want? Or have you changed what you want? And usually people are like, no, I still want that. Okay, well, then we can backtrack to, well, then why didn't you do the thing that you knew was going to get you closer to what you wanted?
Yeah. So you're problem solving, right?
Yeah.
You're relearning, right? So what you're doing is oftentimes when people fall into that, is because they get in that situation and the only thing they had to fall back on is that same faulty circuit that they've relied on for whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Now, for an athlete, what would that faulty circuit be?
Yeah. Oh, man. Being, do you have a specific, like,
like say an athlete is trying to get a faster mile.
Yeah. So let's do this. So, say an athlete,
like that bug is trying to get a faster mile right now.
So when an athlete is and then would it be okay if I kind of close the loop?
Yeah,
on
yeah.
The,
go ahead.
Career part two with the person. When we're talking about somebody getting them to that goal, right, and that safe culture we kind of provide, what happens is it looks like love functions like doubt.
Oh.
And so what's happening is we're not giving them the opportunity to feel that discomfort, to have the opportunity to problem solve and grow. And change. We're not given an opportunity to write that new circuit, right?
Now that bubble wrap culture makes sense.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, it's like what Dean says all the time, which is love don't always look like a hug.
Exactly.
Right.
Dude, yeah, I'm still in that Dean, though.
So. Yeah.
No, but it absolutely, right? And so we do it well, it's well-intentioned, right? And we see this in recovery when people first come out of rehab or they're under, you know, they just start getting sober. Well-meaning family members, what do they tend to do? Well, we don't want to stress them out.
Uh-huh.
You know, we don't want to worry them. You're so afraid of them relapsing. Yes, that's a risk. But what you're not giving them the chance is to face that with support, right? To relearn how to handle those things, mm-hmm. how to manage that, how to stay sober while doing that with the support, which means we don't rewrite the circuit. We don't help them build that confidence, right? And then those goals that they have are lofty that we said, well, I told you we weren't going to get there, right? Well, what do we do to kind of sabotage that without realizing it?
Yeah.
Because we're trying to live. So I guess that's what I mean. We kind of go there and we do that. Right. And so my whole message is, whether it's athletes in here and we'll talk about the mile, is as humans, we tend to underestimate ourselves and others based on what our brain's doing because it's trying to protect us instead of basing our abilities on what we actually, our potential actually is.
Oh, get closer to the mic. That's the note we're getting from the gallery.
So let's put it this way. So going to the miler, just a pop quiz on it. Anybody know, the mile is about 4 laps around a track,
okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. 1,609 meters, right? Does anybody know what the hardest lap is of those 4 laps? Any guesses?
The first one?
I would think the last.
No, the third one.
Really?
The third lap. The first lap, you're pumped up on adrenaline.
Oh, not me.
right?
The first lap, why am I here?
Yeah, like, God, get me off here.
Yes.
Yeah, like, you kind of come off the curve and just kind of, like, sneak off into the, you know, the fence line.
Yeah.
Oh, we've all been there. I can't tell how many times I was in a race, even in college. It's like, what if I just trip over that root, right? Mm. And break, you know, say my ankle is hurt. But that first lap, you're still running on your energy system. It is full. It's like a full tank of gas. And during the second lap, you start to kind of run out a little bit, right? You're burning your gas at that point is oxygen, right? And then that third lap, you're going in oxygen debt. You don't have enough oxygen, and now you're having to burn off other things. And that's when your legs start to burn, your lungs start to burn, your body starts to hurt. You start to feel this pain, right? And our brain is developed to do two things, right? To keep us alive, self-preservation, and avoid or minimize pain as much as possible.
Mm.
Whether it's emotional pain, physical pain, financial pain, any kind of pain you could think of.
So just say again, the brain's two primary functions.
Self-preservation and minimize or avoid pain.
Wow. Yeah. That's just your brain doing brain shit.
It's your brain doing brain shit, man.
Yeah.
Doing what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, the way you've described this third lap so far, you said body's burning, legs are burning, lungs are burning. Why are we running?
Exactly. Yeah, right. Because we're crazy. That's why distance runners are different
breed. Because you're crazy. I don't run. I'm smart. I feel very good from my position here as a non-runner.
I don't recommend it for... If you don't do it, don't do it. You know, honestly, we run because we weren't good at other sports, right? Yeah. But so when you get that point, right, and it's just like when you're craving, you're trying to be sober, it's like your brain doesn't like that pain, right? And so what it does is that sympathetic nervous system, that thing, that fight or flight or freeze or fawn kicks in, right? And it will, in a race, that third lap, it starts to shut you down, right? It limits you. Our brain has like a governor. Right. Like you have a high-performance car, right, and it has a speed limiter, so you won't redline that can protect you, right? So what happens in that race is in that third lap, that governor kicks in because it thinks, oh, no. Your brain's like, whoa, this is, we're about to redline. But in reality, you still have more in you. Right? You have this hidden, this reserve in there.
Oh.
Right? So that protect factor kicks in too soon, all right? And we know this because the fourth lap tends to be faster than the third lap.
Wow, because I can see the end in sight, the brain starts making rationale, and so it starts to dip into that reserve, which on the third lap didn't think was there.
Yep.
Wow. And
it's like, oh, we're done. We're about to be safe.
Right? Yeah.
Now think about that when we're craving as well, and we're trying, and you know, and we get to a point where like, I'm tired of this. I'm tired of this. I'm not going to do it again. But the withdrawals, the symptoms, the stress, whatever it is, starts to hurt.
Mm. Yeah.
Our brain goes in that same mode, and that brain governor kicks in and says, all right, we've reached our limit. This can be really bad. Go use. Hmm. Right? When if we sit that out and we have support and we do all the things that we try to learn, we realize, oh, no, we're good. So our biggest goal, one of our biggest goals, is teaching our brains and teaching people's brains to say, hey, chill out, homie. We're fine. All right?
Yeah.
We got more in us.
Yeah.
So what are, like, outside of, like, the... your brain telling you to stop, like we can't keep going. Like what are other challenges, like mental challenges that athletes might have when they're trying to hit whatever goal that they've set for themselves?
Oh man, so there's like anything, there's things that come from the outside world and things that come from the inside world. Right. So we talked a little bit about the culture. You know, I remember talking to a coach and athlete came up and said, it was in the 3200, it was a 2 mile, that they wanted to run under 10 minutes. Which is a good time, right? Which means you have to run 2 miles back-to-back under 5 minutes. Right? And the coach's response was, I mean, that's, yeah, but I mean, haven't you only run like 4:56 in a mile? Right?
Oh.
Well, intention. Now, what does that tell that athlete?
Yeah, it's not possible.
Not possible. I can't do it. So those are things that come from the outside world. The problem with that is these are artificial limits. They tend to be arbitrary, and they're limited to people, and they don't need to. So... quick example, has anybody here heard of Roger Bannister? Mm-mm. Sir Roger Bannister. He's the first person to ever run a sub-4 minute mile.
Okay.
Right? 1950s, I think 1956. All right. Now, kid you not, at that time, people thought if you ran under 4 minutes for the mile, you would die.
Okay. Right?
Like your respiratory system couldn't handle it, your heart would explode, like it wasn't possible. So Roger Bannister was in med school at the time. And for decades, about 70-something years, people have been trying to run under 4 minutes. Trying, and nobody's getting it. One day, 1956, he finally does it. Runs 359.56.
Wow.
How long do you think it took before the next person ran a sub 4 minute mile?
Pretty quick.
3 weeks.
Wow.
You know, somebody across the pond. This was in Great Britain, right? And that means news had to travel. It had to do, I don't know, telegraph, whatever news it was on, like, social media.
Send
you know?
A dove or...
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
You know, send a pigeon. Carriers.
Paper airplane.
Yeah.
Yeah, pigeon.
You know, Pony Express. It was all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
You know? Now, and then after that...
So as soon as someone heard, oh, it can be done, the limiter, the governor was turned off, and oh, I can do that.
Exactly.
But what about, though, the people who hear that can't be done, like the Wright brothers?
Mm-hmm.
No, we're humans. We don't fly. That's for birds. And the Wright brothers were like, okay, but, like, I'll show you.
Yeah.
Or, like, for me, like, when I inadvertently set a personal record, because I lift weights, and
yeah,
one
nice.
Time, like, a man told me that I should never curl more than 15 pounds, and I was like,
it would.
Fuck you, I say with my 25 pounds, like,
yeah.
You know, that inadvertently, if someone tells me I can't, then I'm like, no, I'm going to do it now, because you yeah. think I can't, and I have to show you, so it's like, what about the opposite, you know, like...
So that's your motivator, right?
Okay.
And sometimes, man, if I could bottle that up, right, and force feed it, right, I think it's good to have a chip on your shoulder sometimes. It's controlled, you know. I think the people who've done the greatest things in the world are the people in that, like you in that situation who are like, let me prove you wrong. Why can't we? Right? I think so many times, again, that loss aversion culture where we're afraid of what we might lose or what the ridicule might be or the negative evaluation, so we don't do things. But then there's a subset of people who say, but what if?
Well, and I think different, too, if you're in on a team, and even if you're on, like, a track team, and your coach, who's a person who's has authority in your life,
yep.
and if your coach is a person saying, ah, I don't think that's possible, you've already mm-hmm. assigned them, you've given them permission to tell you the
oh,
truth,
yeah.
or what you would think is the truth.
Yeah.
So that could be really easy, like, okay, well, I trusted you with everything else, so I'll trust you with that, too.
Yeah. Well, you have a team, and if the culture is, hey, small goals and mediocrity, then you're going to have small brains, too. Right? You're not going to be able to achieve. Right? That's why I think sometimes you see, I was talking to, I think, my son and my brother-in-law also at the time about these wide receivers for water coming out of, I believe, LSU. Just kind of average in college. Amazing NFL stars. Right?
Mm.
Now, what's the difference? The NFL game is harder. Everybody's faster. Right? You got to be, it's so much harder to get open and all those kind of things. I think it's a culture with a toe that can and can't do. Right now they get into the league with these NFL players who are just like, you got to have confidence.
Yeah.
Right. You got to believe in what you're doing. You got to believe in who you are almost to a fault. Right. And then when you see that, it's like that banister effect. Ah, I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So the crazy thing about the brain is it uses previous experiences to predict our future limits. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I have anxiety. I know.
Yeah. Right. So, and that's when the brain governor comes in, right? Kicks in. So when you challenge it and push that experience, when you push that limit,
yeah.
it resets before it kicks in.
When it's like, I have previous experience of, no, I can do this, so I can do it again.
Yep.
Because I'll do that when I go roller skating, and it's been a while, and I'm like going down a hill. I'm like, I'm going to fall.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, I've been down this hill before. Like, I know I can do it.
Now, let me ask you. So when you think like that, like, what changes in your body?
Oh, my gosh. I can't think like that, because when I do think like that, I fall.
Yeah.
Because I remember that is actually what got me over my fear of going downhill, because
yeah.
I was, like, panicking. I was like, I'm just going to fall, and that's all I could think of. And I actually get shaky. Like, first I would get tense, and so then, like, I can't move well enough to actually be able to navigate and not fall. And now, to this day, when I'm, like, nervous, like, my whole body will just go, like, light.
Yes.
And I can't feel it. I don't have enough feeling, and I'm like, uh-oh. But, but I'm like, I can do it. I'm literally talking to myself
yeah.
out loud through it. I feel like a crazy person, and like the runners passing by are probably like, this bitch.
One, what's she doing on top of a hill with skates?
This weirdo on the
yeah.
roller skates
yeah,
talking like, to herself going down a hill.
Happening.
Yeah, but it starts with yeah. mindset. As
yeah.
if I tell myself I can do it, I can do it.
Yeah.
To an extent.
Yeah.
But with
so I mean, I think, like, I'm interjecting here,
no,
but
go.
It's think. Like the importance of like what we're doing, like having these conversations and introducing these concepts and ideas, because if the brain's primary function is to avoid pain and keep us alive, right? Then something going on. Oh,
Christian.
ADD?
Be
what,
here.
Squirrel?
Be here.
Be here now? I'm at the table. you know, but like you're saying mindset, right? Because I'm hearing like two conflicting pieces, right? Yeah. The mind and the brain. Mm. That's where I'm like, okay, so who's in charge? The mind or the brain?
Mm-hmm. Oh, so I guess.
Don't look at me. So I guess, you're the neuropsychologist.
So this is where so what do we mean by mind?
Yeah.
Right? And how we define that?
Yeah.
Right? So when I hear it, I'm thinking like our thoughts, that inner working dialogue.
Okay.
Right? The things perceiving and everything else.
Yeah.
I would say is that mindset. So one thing we talk about is that we're almost obnoxiously, because we, you know, if you know me, you probably know why. It's like, no, this is why we're different. We don't do that. Is our goal isn't to provide just motivational kind of mush,
mm-hmm.
right? We're doing things where it's like, no, this is, it's rooted in neuroscience. Hey, this is making physical change. Like, this is, you know, gonna, it's different. So when we do things like that mindset, when you're telling yourself something, you're not just thinking happy thoughts, right? Mm-hmm. You're not just doing that. What happens is when you talk about something, when you visualize it, when you imagine it, when you watch somebody else do it, right, your brain is changing.
Mm.
Right, it's laying down those new networks, those new circuits we're talking about. Right, then when you go do it, it's almost like it's easier for you because you've already, your brain's already had that idea. It's already laid down the foundation for those new circuits.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So, have you ever? So when I was growing up, my dad and I used to watch a lot of kung fu movies. Like we love Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
Right. And if you ever walked out of a movie, whether it was a fighting movie or whatever, and all of a sudden you're like, I know kung fu.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And you're like doing the moves or whatever.
Yeah.
Right? It's because your brain is terrible at telling the difference between reality and visualization and imagination and what somebody else is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like our brain copies other people.
Yeah.
Right? And so you legit kind of have those moves in there.
Yeah.
Right. Which is why all of a sudden you kind of feel a bit more like smooth with it, you know.
But that's why like representation is so important, mm-hmm. you know, and people are like, oh, it's not a big deal if, you know, if the main character looks like this or if the family looks like this. And
oh,
it's like,
is.
But no, but it is.
It is. Right. Because the more you can see yourself in it. Right. So it's cool. So I think it's cool. These things called mirror neurons. Right. I'm sure you guys probably know about them, so I probably just won't be redundant.
Uh-huh. I learned when I read it right here.
Nice.
Yeah.
Sorry, when
mirror neurons.
Off the cuff.
Totally.
I didn't read it. It was off the cuff at the start of the show.
I was impressed. I was like, she knows what I do better than I do. she didn't just talk, man.
What is a mirror neuron?
Can you even say it?
Mirror neuron.
Mirror neuron. Boy, that's that southern. you've been down here in South too
I've
long.
I've been too long here to the mirror neurons.
Back out there at West Coast.
Damn our ducks.
Well, y'all, mirror neurons. So, mirror neurons, man, they're these cool things. So,
look how excited he's getting.
I know, I love it.
I love it.
I start to geek out. So, we discovered them. So, all right. So, there's these researchers working with monkeys.
Okay.
Right? And what they're doing is they're tracking the brain, while seeing what parts of the brain's firing when they do things, when they, like, eat lunch or they eat, right? And you say, oh, if they lift up the fork and everything's firing that part of the brain, kind of similar to humans, probably the same thing. What they realized one day is the monkeys were still hooked up to the monitor, and it was lunchtime. So, scientists go grab their lunch, you come in, they start eating their lunch. And they see that the monkeys are watching them eat. And as they're eating their food, they start looking at the monitors and realize that the parts of the brain in the monkeys that usually light up when they're eating are lighting up as they watch them eat.
Oh.
Right? So what we realized is when we watch people do something great or not, whatever they're watching, the same neurons, the same brain cells are firing in their brain to do that activity.
Oh,
we'll
shit.
Fire in ours.
So, like, literally monkey see, monkey do?
Exactly.
Okay.
Oh, exactly.
Dang.
Yeah. Right?
No, I mean, like, seriously, think about what you know, what kind of content have you, or have I consumed, mm-hmm. like, in the last, you know, of violence or, you know, like, crazy things that you cannot see and to realize my brain is, like, mirroring that.
But isn't there the other side of it where it's like when you watch it get lived out, now you don't need to do it because the whole, like, when people are like, oh, well, the violent video games are ruining our kids, and it's like,
right.
But it's also not,
right.
Because it can be, you know, therapeutic in a way to, like,
yeah.
If I watch a violent movie or, like, go do something, like, not do something violent, but
hold on,
let me back
hold
up
on.
Oh, hey, do we need a kill the mic on this one?
Yeah.
This ain't, this ain't the most honest show.
Yeah, okay? It is. That's different, man.
Okay, because I was thinking about going to a metal show, which is like an intense environment.
Yes. You hit the pit, not, man. I got you.
Like doing something like that, then I know I'm not going to act on like the violent thought. Not Jesus Christ.
Do we need, hey. So,
yeah, we're gonna help you out.
Is it prayer time?
Is it prayer time? I'm doing a terrible job of explaining what I'm trying to say.
Well, maybe that's too. Like, I think like most stories in American cinema or TV are revenge stories.
Yeah,
right. Like that's usually the a bad thing happens to a good guy, and he has to go and avenge whatever bad thing happened. And so it's almost like that art. Mimicking life or life mimicking art, right? But if that's the kind of stuff you're consuming constantly, right, it's no wonder why there's so much self-righteous, so much polarization, because it's about me versus them. Mm-hmm. and subconsciously you might be programming yourself to be more in that defensive revenge, don't do me wrong because I'll get you back, which is
and especially if it's multiple sources, right? Like the buzzword here past 10 years or so has been echo chamber.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and we tend to hang around people who are like us, who we can identify in, partially because of those mirror neurons, right? That's where we get empathy from as well. It's the only great thing. So there's so much more goes into like the video game content, like, you know, research shows that there's so many, not really, right? And there's so many more benefits of it with moderation, like anything, right? So it's how often you consume it, and it does drive our personality. It can, right? And what we're looking at here is, so here's how it could be good. So let's say, I think Bailey, and I was talking to Bailey about this earlier before the show, is do you remember when you first kind of stepped into recovery and you first started meeting people who were on the journey already, right, sobriety, and you'd kind of meet that person or these people who were just living it?
Hmm.
You know, they're living in it, right? And you wanted to be like that. And the more you're around them, even if they weren't sponsoring you, it was like interaction, you started to kind of think like them, started to live like them, and be encouraged, right? That's mirror neurons, right? But it's important to us. There's meaning to it, right? Yeah. So part of mirror neurons also is, there's a, I call it smile, right? So first is you see someone or somebody doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Then you make sense of it. Why are they doing it? What's the goal? What are they getting out of it? Then you imitate it, right? And you start to do it, right? And then you learn. And then you learn to do it.
Mm.
And then that's how you learn everything. Right?
Smile.
Smile.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're both looking at each other like, I'm trying to follow.
Oh, I was with it.
Oh, you were with it.
I was with it. My mirror neurons were
reflecting like crazy, man. Mirror on the wall. Yeah.
So you see, then you
make sense of it.
Then you imitate.
Then you learn it.
Then you learn it.
And you apply it to everything.
So it's kind of like some of us might say, "Fake it till you make it." Kind of.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Now, so when we do that as kids, right? How do kids learn?
Yeah.
Watching.
They watch. They model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
That's awesome. Like when people say, do as I say, not as I do, like that doesn't work.
Exactly. Because I'm watching you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? And our brains are so smart, we pick up on it. Have you ever met somebody for the first time in a group and everybody's like, oh, that's such a cool person, whatever, and you're like, I don't know something about that person.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
He's at this table.
Yeah. Right? I know. Right? And people are like, oh, I got a good gut feeling, I got good intuition. Right.
Yeah.
So those mirror neurons, they're picking up on it without you realizing it, and it's telling you something.
Oh, like, oh, I've seen this before.
Yeah, or something like, there's something like you're reflecting, like, because it's firing, since they're feeling it and experiencing it and demonstrating it, it's also firing in your brain, so you're kind of picking up on that feeling, right? And that's where I get that feeling. So somebody's being disingenuous.
Mm-hmm.
What they're saying and presenting isn't congruent with what they're, to some of their subtle features.
Right? Yeah.
Like, you pick up on it. So it's like, if you're around happy people, you tend to be more happy.
Mm-hmm.
If you're around people who use all the time, you tend to use more.
Mm-hmm.
If you're around people who are strong in recovery and sobriety, you have a better chance of doing it. Right? It's that old cliche of like you become who you hang around with.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I love how what you just described, what's happening on like a scientific level, mirror neurons, neuroning,
Neuroning?
Yeah, neuroning.
Let me check with judges. Yeah, it works.
But, like, I think culturally we would call that, like what you said, like intuition or spiritual guidance or something like that. And I love the connection of something like spiritual and then connecting it to science, which to me doesn't discredit the spiritual. It just makes what spiritual is saying more true.
Yeah.
No, this, we see, scientifically see this happening. That's why you can, you're picking up on that because your brain is picking up on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I love when it's like, because like spirituality terms and stuff existed to explain what we can't explain yet. And then as science has progressed over the years, now there's like, no, here's the research and the terms for what's actually happening. Like, it's been happening this entire time. Like, humans were correct. This happens. Here's, you know, here's why. Here's how. And there's still so much, like, that's left to be explained. But that with like, oh, I have a gut feeling, but you're saying it could just be mirror neuron. I can't say it now.
Because you're mirroring his, you know.
Yeah, my mirror neurons. Mirror neurons. That's really cool.
Yeah, that's
speaking of, like, you know, I make fun of my partner Christy.
That chick.
Yeah, that chick. You know, when we were living in Atlanta, that chick, she would get on the phone and she talked to, you know, her nana and grandma almost every day, and her mom as well. And when she started the phone conversation, she talked like, you know, my boo, normal wife. About 5 minutes into conversation, it got a little bit more twangy. Mm. Right. By the end of conversation, it was like full blown Tennessee accent. Like, who are you?
Mm.
Right. But it was those mirror neurons, man. We start to sync up, right?
All right. So what about, like, overcoming the adversities? Like, whether it's the internal environment, the external environment, you know, your brain is saying, that's it, we're done, but your body has more. Mm-hmm. How do you know the body has more? How do you know when to push back and when it's, like, actually going to be detrimental?
Yeah. Well, it depends on what context, right? Are we talking about, like, in a sports world? Or are we talking about just in...
Yeah, obviously.
About in general. About, people say you can die from a broken heart. So, like, let's talk about it.
Yeah. So, so we know. So, one of the ways to know, like, if we're looking at a sports world, is kind of that example I gave where people in a mile, their third lap tends to be their slowest, which suggests, like, you're exhausted. You're out of gas, right? You're physically fatigued, right? But then why is their fourth lap faster? It shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. Right? And so, when we look at studies, they'll have people who'll do the same thing, to have them exert a lot of energy as much as they can, go as hard as you can, and then they'll say, hey, this is the last one, right? Go as hard as you can, and it's much better than the one right before it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's showing that brain governor is kicking in. It's saying, it comes in as a protective factor. It's saying, like, hey, we need to make sure we don't hurt ourselves, we don't completely gas, we keep a little bit in the reserve. Okay. From an evolutionary standpoint, you know, here's why it's once upon a time, back in the day, like on a Wednesday, when we had to run away from tigers, right? Let's say you're running away, you hear it, you're running, and like that fight or flight kicks in, right? So you run faster than you ever run before, and you start to finally get away, right? And you think you're done. You think you're gone. You've escaped a tiger. You're like, oh, good. And all of a sudden, you hear some rustling. You're like, son of a bitch, that tiger's still there.
Yeah.
Right? You need one last ditch effort, one last sprint to save your life. That's the reserve.
Mm-hmm.
That brain governor kicked in to say, hey, you may not be escaped. We need to make sure we put some reserve just in case you need it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Right? In the real world, we're not running away from tigers anymore.
If you're lucky.
Right? If you're lucky, right? Very rare. There's only been a few races I've seen where there's a tiger at the end of the finish line.
Right.
Right? So it's saying, like, no. We don't need to preserve that. Let's dip into it now.
Yeah.
Right? It's the same with recovery, except the tiger is those withdrawal symptoms, right? Or whatever's going on, the distress, everything that's causes one to relapse. Right.
So what would be like some of the things you as your work? Yeah. Like, what would be the practical steps to begin to override that other than mindset?
Yeah. So good. So what we do is we recreate it. Right.
Okay.
As much as we can. So let's say somebody is shutting down that third lap, or if it's 2 mile lap, 5 or 7, or if it's basketball. I'm about to start working with this basketball player who is money from the 3-point line. He shoots greater than 40% from 3-point, which is crazy for those who don't know about sports. But when he gets in the game and the ball gets in his hand, will not shoot.
Mm.
Right? Mm. Almost actively chooses not to shoot. Will pass it. Coaches are flubmates. Parents, you know, whatever. Has a lot of potential, right? That brain governor's kicking in, right? So I'm like, no. Let's preserve. All right? So what we do is, like, hey, first we got to acknowledge it. Now let's recreate it. Right? So I'm going to try to put you in situations to trigger that. But what we're going to do is we're going to use mindset, we're going to use visualization, we're going to use talking, whatever, to get you through that, right? And every time you do, your brain starts to realize, this is safe, right? I can do this. So for a runner, I love doing this to runners. They don't love it, but I love it. where if we're doing, for me, our hardest workouts are on Mondays. I call them Hell Mondays because you're gonna. The goal is to try. You're trying to get you to die.
Isn't Monday hard enough as it is?
I know, but you know, hey, it helps build strength.
Evil.
Yeah, I know. so I might say, hey, you know what? We're gonna do 4 800 meter repeats. So it's 2 laps on track. You can do them hard. And if you run to 800 in, you know, in 2 minutes and 30 seconds, you get 2 minutes and 30 second break. So by the time you get to that fourth one, you are gassed. Like you are dying.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they finish, I'll say, hey, I mean, you don't have to. But it would be a ridiculous idea if you do one more. You think you got that? Can you handle that? Right?
What do most people do?
Most of them will do it for different reasons. I say, but if you're going to do it, you got to commit to me, homie. Like, I don't want any, there's no half measure. If you do this, you go all out. Like, you run, you don't get there and waffle it in. So they'll do it. And usually that ends up being their best one.
Wow.
Right. Now, what if they just teach that brain governor?
Yeah.
You're teaching them, hey, just because your brain is telling you that your body has failed doesn't mean that it has. Your body isn't failing. Your brain is just telling you that it's failing, right?
Wow.
And so now that brain has that evidence. Remember we said our brain will set our future limits based on our previous experiences? Now that becomes a previous experience. So things like now when they get in the race and they get into that third lap and they start to feel that, right? The governor's like, let me ease up a bit and let them do their thing.
Yeah, I keep hearing, if you want self-esteem, do esteemable acts.
Exactly, man.
Mm. Right?
Yeah, God.
Or like we say, just do the next right thing. Then if you keep stacking enough of those, you know, which for me is like small things, you know, like taking out the trash, even though it's technically my son's job, you know, but I can take out the trash.
I hope he's listening.
Yeah, I hope he's listening. Piece of trash.
Clip it. Send it to him.
Clip it. But it's a dumb small thing. It really is. But for me, I have an inner dialogue about the trash. Seriously, I'm not being facetious.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to talk to myself about this freaking trash. And all it is really just take the trash out. And one place I did take action in this is the kitchen. So I just one day decided that I was going to do more ownership of the kitchen.
Yeah.
Like the dishes, wiping it down. Bear in mind, like, I've just pretended to not be good at dishes for 20 years. So I was never expected to do the dishes.
That's the most husband-y thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. But what happened was I did it. I cooked, and then I cleaned.
Yeah.
And then I felt freaking great. Because I was like, oh, everything's in its right place. I wiped the counters down. Like, I did it like my mom used to do it, you know? And now that's become... like my habit. There's some days where I'm just like, fuck this kitchen. But for the most part, like because I my new experience is, it feels good to have a tidy kitchen and turn that light off. And I'm reminded of my grandmother. She'd say, the kitchen is closed. You know, like we're just saying, don't go in the kitchen and mess my shit up.
My mom used to do the same thing. Yeah. She'd say, don't go in there. Don't mess it up. Don't open that fridge.
Yeah.
Kitchen's closed.
Damn, don't even open the fridge.
The kitchen is closed. And so those are small. For me, like those, that's a huge pattern to break, even though it's a tiny pattern. And I can sense the reverberation of breaking that small pattern of just taking the trash out, just clean the dishes, and how that affects kind of reverberates out the rest of my life, how I show up at work or how I show up for other people. I notice like I'll answer the phone even though I really don't want to answer the phone. I never want to answer the phone, by the way.
I'm going to call you later.
Yeah. I start to do the things that I don't really want to do.
Starts to generalize.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what you're describing there is that neuroplasticity, right? You're rewriting these circuits, and every time you do it, it gets easier. So now, whenever you have that cue, that trigger, wherever that trigger is, to at first was like, I'm not doing these damn dishes. I'm acting like I suck at them.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Now every time you do it, now your brain hits that cue, and a new response is, that's kind of rewarding.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? And then every time you do it, the more you do it, the more likely you have that same experience.
Yeah.
So now, every time you get into the kitchen, your brain's default program is going to be to do it. And then your brain's like, I'm kind of lazy. I want to rewrite a whole program. Let's take this program because I bet it'll work for the phone answering too.
Right. Yeah.
It starts to generalize.
Yeah.
That's so crazy. What is the environment that you set up when you're working with somebody? Like, how are you? So when you have somebody who can, like, is doing sport ball real good in practice and then sport ball game time, not good. Yeah. I know sports.
It's like that old Trey Parker, Matt Stone movie, basketball. Yeah, it just makes it all up.
So obviously you're not like next to them on the court, like, no, you can do it. Like, override that brain governor. Yeah. Like, how are you doing this?
So I think the first step is knowledge, right? What we come to find is that for sport ballers is that, once they understand how their brain works, right, they start to do instead of doubt, right?
Yeah, because you're telling them, like, here's the biology of it.
Yep.
All the morality, all the thoughts you might have of it, but here's actually what's actually happening.
Exactly.
So I know that was my experience, like, when I saw an addictionologist, and she did a brain scan, and she told me how my brain was functioning or dysfunctioning or whatever. It took so much pressure off.
Yeah.
Because then I was just like, oh, that's just like a biological response. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to assign meaning or value or morality to it. It's just literally what it's doing, what it's supposed to do. Yep. Yeah.
It's just our brain. It does what, because our brain is literally in a black box. It has no idea what's going on outside the world. It does its thing based on the information we get and what we tell it. Right. And so when it's doing its thing well, it's great.
The brain isn't morally judging or any of that.
No. It's just going based on what the cues are and what it's been wired to do.
Yeah.
Right.
So if you've wired it to be morally judgy,
then yes. Absolutely. But I think the beautiful thing you said there is it takes that negative content, it takes that pressure off of you. Because we're mean and making creatures, and we got to figure out why this is happening. Yeah. And if we don't know what the culprit, so to speak, is, we tend to put it on ourselves or others.
Yeah.
But you're putting it in, you're putting it on something tangible, right? So now you have a target. You have something that's outside of you, right? I mean, it's inside, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Right? Now, that does a couple of things. One, it helps you understand and cut yourself some slack. Two, as we know this, our addictions don't just affect us. They affect everybody around us.
Mm-hmm.
An athlete who's having a hard time doesn't just affect them. It affects their teammates, their coaches, their parents. Right.
Yeah.
And people, as understanding as they try to be, will have to put the blame or something, feels frustrated on something, so they feel frustrated with the person. Mm. Right.
Yeah.
The addict, the person who's having trouble in sports, whatever, when people are counting on them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But when you bring the brain in the picture, say, hey, actually, this is what's going on. Here's what's happening. It takes that off the person.
Yeah.
Now family members, teammates, coaches, whoever, are more willing to be understanding. They have more empathy, and that's a culture of problem solving and support.
And then when you're on that third lap, mm-hmm. you're like, oh, this is just my governor kicking in.
Exactly.
I can push harder.
I can push it, right? Yeah. You have control now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what do we have? Like, we always feel like, especially with addictions, like, out of control.
Loss of control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have control. We have a way to actually do something to fix it, to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing is just that education. I usually start with, it's like, hey, our brain's made up of these brain cells called neurons. That's what you're saying, brain cells, like skin cells and everything else. They all connect with each other and talk to each other. And I know I've asked this question a couple of times on the show already, so you may already know this, Christian, but so I'll ask you, sport baller referencer. Sarah, any idea how many brain cells we have? How many cells make up the human brain?
Not enough.
Not enough, usually, and we lose them.
Yeah, right. I have no idea.
Right. Take a guess on number.
I have no frame of reference to even know what number family it should be in.
This is a pretty accurate indication of the size of our
brain. How many, like, commas should be in the number?
I can't tell you. That takes the fun out of it.
I don't know.
It's not a test.
It feels like
a test.
It's
pass
content.
Fail. I'm going to embarrass myself.
1 million?
1 million in the
well, room. Well, about 50 million.
50 million?
Yeah.
Good guess. Good guess. Lowest guess I ever got was one. Yeah,
I wanted to say two.
Yeah.
There's two homies in there.
Just two homies. They're like, holding hands.
They're just chilling, being happy. Yeah. You know?
I don't know about happy, thing, but you know, they're there. Like,
sometimes. You know, we have 80 to 100 billion.
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 Damn, I was going to say billion, but for a second, I was like, that's not a real number.
Let this be an evidence and to rewrite that circuit to not doubt yourself.
Look, man.
80 to 100 billion.
Billion with a B.
Just take a moment. Yeah, it's constant, like, just a fathom.
That's neurons?
Neurons, brain cells. 80 to 100 billion is in that about 3.5 pound of flesh in our head. It controls everything that we do, everything that we think, everything that we remember, everything that we feel, every action, every memory, just our language, everything we say, our spirituality, our recovery, our addiction controls everything. How we love our partners, how we don't, the way we react and respond, what we learn,
no
what we don't
wonder.
Learn.
Emotions. Well, I'm anxious
emotions,
all the time.
Behaviors,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
800 billion. Now, think that number. So think of how much a million is. You need 999 million to get 1 billion, right? And then you got 80 to 100 more of those.
Wow.
Right. Now, those neurons, when we said they form these new connections, they run these new circuits and programs, they got to connect with each other to talk and work together. They don't just form one connection. They form tens of thousands of connections. 80 to 100 billion neurons forming tens of thousands of connections, hundreds of trillions of connections running through your brain.
Yeah.
Hundreds of trillions. A lot of circuits. Because remember, everything we've ever learned how to do and that we do or anything new that we learn, it's new circuits being wired.
Like even like the automatic things, like automatic. I'm moving my hands as I'm talking, yep. Or, you know, when you just get up to walk, your brain's still doing brain shit to make all that happen.
Yeah, it's just automatic. Because remember, as a kid, at one point, we didn't do that.
Yeah.
Right? Remember watching baby when he first starts to walk in that process?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how unstable it is, like when you're at the top of the hill and kind of unstable, right, until you got it down, right, until it becomes automatic. That's learning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's awkward at first. So when we say, hey, dude, or hey, whatever, it's like, 800 billion, it's a lot, right? So the things you're having trouble with, not necessarily your fault, man, but your responsibility, we can work on it.
Mm-hmm.
All we're going to do is rewire those circuits.
It's not your fault, but it is your responsibility.
Yeah.
But now you know what it is, but now you have power because you know you can have some control over it. And all we're going to do is do some rewiring. I usually explain it something like, I don't know, has anybody ever had a house or I grew up not – with a lot of money, so where you've been in a house and you live in a house, you've been in somebody's house where the wiring just wasn't quite right.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You flip a switch and maybe the fan turns on in the other room.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Oh, and then they tell you what switch does what.
Yeah. It's like, bro, who let their uncle come and wire this house?
Right.
Right? So the house isn't bad. Just some faulty wiring.
Yeah.
Neuroplasticity is like the electrician that comes in and just recircuits things, rewires things, so that when you turn on a light switch, the lights turn on the right room. And it might be a room that you forgot you even had, or a room that you ever knew you had. And that's what we're doing. People aren't reaching their peak because of a lack of talent. They're not reaching their full talent. So they're wired to access those rooms. So say all we're gonna do is rewire your circuitry, man.
Hmm.
So when you get here,
I'm feeling like a little inspired right now, to be honest with you.
Me too.
Hell yeah.
Like my little brother is an athlete, and I'm gonna be like, hey bro.
Yeah.
Listen to this one. Shout out.
Yeah.
Don't hit up Dr. Zach, man. Like, look, you know.
I mean, it's kind of like, you know, I always, and I still hate it when someone's just like, you know, visualize it or whatever, you know, and I think I like that Dave Chappelle skit of like, just tell those poor kids in Africa to visualize a sandwich, you know, like visualize. But it's essentially what we're saying here is, and how important imagination is, mm-hmm. how important creativity is.
Oh, yes.
And then I think too, like how important vulnerability is because, you know, we don't want to say that we're scared that we're going to fail at this thing.
Yeah.
But if you say that you're scared you're going to fail with the right person, then you can talk about it.
Yep.
And then that provides the opportunity for these neurons to start. And then you can visualize. And then you might see yourself in the possibility of whatever that goal is, however simple or grandiose it is.
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes we can't achieve what we haven't seen, right?
Yeah.
And at the same thing, if you haven't visualized it, if you aren't seeing it, right, you're not giving your brain that information. Right? And that's what I mean when I say it's like, you know, this isn't motivational mush or fluff. It's like, no. Visualization, like you're actually changing your brain, right? You're making those neurons connect, right? And again, since our brain is terrible at telling the difference between reality and what we imagine, it's almost as if we're doing that thing, right? So when we actually go and do it, right, we got that framework, and it's easier now.
That's a lot of, like, my creative process for, like, video, and I kind of, a lot of the work is actually me waiting around to see it.
Yeah.
Once I see it, like, if someone comes to me and says, here's the project, and we're going to do this thing, if I can see it, it is going to be fun. I know every move to make because I've been able to, I can visualize it, and I can just do it.
You've laid the blueprint.
And sometimes it's not as clear, and so it might take a day or a nap even, to be honest. Like,
no, it's just to show that, yeah.
And then I can, once I see it, then it's like, oh, now I know the steps to take to get it. But I have to kind of visualize it in order to get there.
Yeah. There's actually studies that show, like, when we learn new things, the time that our brain consolidates or really solidifies that new information most is when we're sleeping.
Really?
Yeah. That's why sometimes people will say, yeah, I woke up out of my sleep and I had the epiphany. Right? Mm. They've been trying to figure something out for so long.
Yeah.
And then they wake up, it's like, I got it.
Yeah.
Right? It's because when we sleep, our brain shuts down everything else. It kind of narrows a bit to let things start to clear out the waste and everything. And then it's like those things start to consolidate and come together.
Yeah.
Right? So sleep's okay, man.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, you're absolutely right. You're actually rewiring, you're laying that framework, right? So it's like, I might say to this person, it's like, all right, hey, here's how we're going to start. Tell me what happens, right? What's different between when you get the ball in practice and shoot lights out versus when you get the ball in a game and your first instinct is to get rid of the ball, right? And they might say something like, well, in practice, you know, nobody's there. It's just my teammates. And I've done it 100 times before, and it's easy, right? And if I miss, it's no big deal because it's practice, right? But in the game, there's consequences. People are watching. My parents put a lot of stress on me. There's college scouts, right? It's a big game. There's a lot riding on it. There's a fear of loss.
Mm.
Right? Now, we'll stay there and say, hey, you know what? That's not a mental barrier. It's not built to block. That's a faulty circuit.
Yeah.
And that faulty circuit has been run so many times that as soon as you get the ball, that light switch in that house gets flipped up, but the light in the other room turns on.
Mm. Yeah.
But in practice, the wiring is great.
That's why you're good, I think, the perfect person for this, because you've been through shit in your life, and because you've been an athlete, when you sit and you're talking to an athlete, because it's got to be difficult, especially like an athlete, right? Yeah. Someone who is expected to perform at a high level, to get vulnerable and to get into those details. So you have to approach it with some humility, with some sacredness, with some honor. Of saying, hey, you can. We're just talking here, right?
Yeah.
To allow them the ability, because if they don't, because if you tell them, that's one thing. But if they say it, that's where the power is, right?
Exactly.
Yep. Yeah.
When they adopt it, or if they find it on their own by kind of urging them there.
Yeah.
You know, and it is. It's I don't care what you do in life. I don't care what profession you're in. I don't care what you're trying to get out of life. Who you're working with. You can have the best message in the world, but if the person or people you're talking to, if they don't feel heard, they don't feel understood, and if they don't feel safe, then I can hear you.
Mm.
All right. So your first goal, I feel, as a human,
clip it and send it to every church in America.
Every church, please.
Thinking that,
please. Yeah.
We're hanging out too much. We're like on the same brainwave. We're on the same
frequency, man. Yeah.
Our mirror neurons.
Space thinking.
It's a spicy marinara. It's spicy marinerons.
That's gonna be on a shirt. I know it.
Spicy marinara.
Spicy marinara, boy. Them spicy neurons linking up.
Boy, we just got your whole new campaign for your social media strategy.
Man, I'm about to launch a whole new campaign.
Tell your PR person, Carson, what the new game plan is.
She keeps me in line, man. She's
not mirror neurons.
Not mirror neurons. God.
How are we on time?
But I'll just keep talking, yeah, so I don't...
Well, as we do come in for a landing, how can somebody get in touch with the services you provide?
Absolutely. They can go to our website. It's North Point Neuropsychology, which is a long phrase. Neurosports Performance is a subsidiary. It's under our North Point Neuropsychology company. Or they can find me on Instagram at zach.yanis, zac.yanis. Our email is neuroinfo, neuroinfo at att.net. And our phone number is 615-553-1499. And just reach out. We offer, you know, we have a sliding scale. So for some people, it's free consultation. For others, it's at the most, it's like $69. Just to be like, hey, where do you need to start? What can we offer?
And you're working with, it sounds like some of the examples you're using is like high school students or?
I love working with high school students, man. Because I think that's where we can have the most impact on lives. Again, based just on my story and what I've seen, and it's just that transformational time in life, all right?
Yeah, because once you pick that, if you pick that up at a young age, that carries on through your life.
Absolutely, beyond sports.
Yeah.
When you're finished with sports, when you're finished with athletics. And that's the goal, right, is I want people to run faster times. I want people to score more points. I want people to jump higher and just feel confident. But what they're learning along the way, well, all that rewiring we're doing in your brain, right, all those things, the goal is small percentage of people are actually going to do that for a living. It's usually the vehicle for the next thing. But the lessons they learn, the way the brain's wired now, right, that translates so well to life.
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's our goal, man.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I could talk to you for like a whole other 2 hours.
Yeah, don't say that because I will.
Don't want to hold everybody hostage. Yeah. Yeah, is there one last little tidbit you want to give to our audience? Maybe something they can start doing today to improve their resilience?
Yeah, I think the first thing is just to realize no matter what it is in life is that whatever you think your limitations are, whatever that voice in your head is saying, hey, this is enough, right? It's too much, right? Just know it's trying to help you, but it's just trying to protect you, but there's more in you, right? And the first step is just realizing that, and then to start finding ways to, you know, let it know, hey, we're okay. We got more in us.
Nice.
Right on.
So, yeah. Thank you to our donors, supporters, and everybody for making this show and this studio and this place possible. This has been another episode of The Most High Show.